Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NY Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Laufer, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The NY Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another exciting episode of NucleCast, a podcast of the ANWA Deterrence Center. The great thing about ANWA and NucleCast is that we never have a bad guest, ever, and we're going to continue that tradition today. We've got Brent Sadler, who you probably know him, especially if you're former Navy, you know, Captain Sadler. You could have served with him at some point. But he's a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation today, and he writes quite a bit on naval issues. And, you know, for the Navy, China and Asia are, you know, the primary focus. And so he writes a lot about what's going on in Asia. And so, you know, we wanted, you know, Brent, welcome to the show, by the way. It's great to have you here. And, you know, we don't really talk about Navy issues that much. We have a tendency to focus on, you know, we do a lot of nuclear enterprise, DOE, NNSA, and a lot of Air Force because, you know, I have a long Air Force background, so that tends to be our focus. So it's great to have you for one of our less often naval-focused episodes. So welcome to NucleCast.
No, thanks for having me on today.
So shipbuilding. The Navy is at the smallest that it's been since the interwar years, between World War I and World War II. And that has left us, you know, Reagan wanted a 500 ship Navy, if I recall correctly. You know, we're down to just under 300 ships, I think. We're getting pretty small and we're having trouble. We have had some folks from the Navy who are in the shipbuilding sector that have talked a little bit, particularly the challenge with Columbia. And so, as you focus more broadly on shipbuilding across the surface fleet, across, you know, building Columbia, building the new fast attacks, you know, how do you see the challenge that we're facing? And then, of course, with China has the largest Navy in the world right now, and, you know, so they're outpacing us considerably. They can build ships much faster. They have many more shipyards, many more docks. So tell us about where we are, what do we do, what are our problems, how do we prepare ourselves for the challenges of the future?
Yeah, great question. Thanks again for having me on today. I guess the first thing, just to say, China's not 10 feet tall, and if they are, their feet are made of clay. So this is not it's a daunting challenge. Sure. The best thing to think about this is that we're in a new Cold War. China's been in a new Cold War really since, you know, the night after Tiananmen Square, all the way back in 1989, because they decided we were their principal threat. We've only woken up to this in the last few years, and our Navy was never really deliberately planning for a larger fleet until recent past, really 2016. You know, the fleet size of 355 ships was the new goal. The problem is, 20 years before that, we've kind of been in a spiral, industrial wise, and even within the Navy, you know, manning the ships as well, for a trajectory of shrinkage. Not because it was a plan to shrink the Navy. It just became a reality over budget after budget of cutting corners, making do on the backs of the sailors and maintenance and meeting mission requirements, really, again, on the backs of the sailors. And really the attempt to try to turn the tide politically started 5-6 years ago as Trump was leaving office. The Navy was building up a plan, but just got delayed. We didn't see much movement the last 4 years. Now we have a president, a Congress, Democrats and Republicans that are coming together to try to address the issue. But you can't just snap your fingers and wish this away. Industry takes 3 to 5 years to really grow back. Takes longer if you have regulatory concerns that you can't get out of the way to 7 or 9 years. Unfortunately, we don't have the time. So it really kind of constrains us. We have to do what we can with what we have. We have to find new ways to operate the fleet, but we also have to start building up the industrial capacity so that if China decides to go to war next year, the 2027 Davidson window, that we can, like we did in 1941 to 42, rapidly build up our industrial might and start putting out ships to sea. But sadly, we are far behind in the game.
So in 1994, that was 30 years ago. And at that time, we were short of shipyards. You know, we didn't quite have what we needed. And so if we wanted to flex for a conflict, I'm not quite sure how we would do that because we've lost capacity from, you know, that period. And that seems to be one of the things, like the docks to build is such a big challenge. Is that, you know, something that you see, and do you see a solution for it?
Yeah, the shipyard capacity is a serious problem. And you know, I graduated from the Naval Academy in 1994. So I came into the fleet right about that same time. And everything was about the peace dividend, cashing in on the peace dividend. In the mid-90s, by 1998, we closed half of the remaining public shipyards. And the public shipyards are run by the Navy. These are the yards that do all the nuclear maintenance on the submarines and the aircraft carriers. That was a mistake. They should have known then, at the time, that that was cutting too much. But the euphoria of the end of history and everything, and this pursuit of a peace dividend blinded us to the clear threats that were coming on the horizon. We should have known about China. There was a lot of indications by 1996, the Taiwan crisis, 97, it was clear. But we cut too much. On the commercial side, there's this thing called the Last Supper. Apparently, early in Clinton's presidency in 92, 93, they had all of the prime defense contractors, shipbuilders that are in this, and they said, look, we're not going to have enough orders for you guys to survive, so you're going to have to start to merge and have acquisitions and just reduce the number of you folks. And it landed like a lead balloon, and it resulted in a lot of reduction in the capacity across the board defense-wise. But for the shipbuilders, we got into a situation where we really have a captive production line, and we have a single customer now. The U.S. government's the only customer for shipbuilding in the United States, unfortunately. That also means we only have a handful of shipbuilders, so they also are holding the U.S. government captive. And so we're in this very bad situation, not enough choices, not enough capacity. But your point about how do we get out of it, and thankfully you've got a president who's very excited about this. He's made numerous statements about it. We hadn't had that in living memory. At the same time that we've got, again, bipartisan support for this issue in Congress. It's the Building Ships for America Act is kind of what I'm pointing at. And we can't grow naval shipbuilding and a bigger ship repair and sustainment industry without addressing the industries writ large, the sector. And so this legislation is a key way to try to incentivize direct investments into that. And we already attract that; those efforts are already attracting foreign capital, which is then attracting even more American investment into the maritime industrial base to include shipbuilding, naval shipbuilding. So Philly Shipyard comes to mind. Yeah.
So one of the things I've wondered about, you know, for if you really want to get folks into it, they tend to want more than just one market. So you know, like with the aircraft manufacturers. You know, they'll, you know, Boeing, for example, they make fighters and they make commercial jets. Is there any potential for, you know, our shipbuilders, you know, when let's say, for example, if there is a lull at 5, 10, 15 years down the road where they've built what the Navy asked for, that they can shift to commercial manufacture? Or is that just something that has been taken over by the Chinese, by the South Koreans have a big, they manufacture a lot of commercial shipping? Or is it something that we could do here to sort of smooth out that, you know, how do you think that is in terms of its potential?
Yeah, I would say the sector, the American maritime industrial sector, to include naval shipbuilding, overall the commercial as well, needs a disruptor. And they're not going to get a disruptor from within the industry as it exists today. So someone who might be involved in logistics, like aviation, getting into shipbuilding, that would be great, perhaps, might be the right kind of mentality. Maybe another could be someone that's involved in thinking about AI and software might also be someone to get in there. The issue is we need someone like an Elon Musk, and I'm thinking about SpaceX, where they tried to present an evolutionary approach to really kind of evolutionary, like jumping fast ahead with SpaceX approach to NASA and to the military. And they were told, oh, no, we want you to do it this way. And thankfully, SpaceX refused and said, we can build a better rocket ship. We're going to do it our own way, and we'll present you a better, cheaper solution. And they did. We need disruptors that can come forward with, I can build a better destroyer, or I can build a better submarine, and just do it, so to speak. Maybe a submarine is a bridge too far, but in the commercial sector, we need that very badly. And the other part of it is we need a vision of, like, what is it going to be that is America's new maritime comparative advantage? Because you can't have a domestic shipbuilding industry if you can't compete globally. And that's the missing ingredient. We haven't competed. We've chosen not to compete in global shipbuilding. And our naval shipbuilding has suffered as a consequence. So we got to have a disruptor. We have to have a vision of what is America's maritime comparative advantage going to be. I think part of it's nuclear, by the way.
Yeah. So, you know, it's funny you mentioned that, because AUKUS, I think of AUKUS. And as I've talked to some of my Australian colleagues, you know, one of the things they've said is, hey, you know, we have shipyards and we manufacture commercial vessels. We would love for you to, you know, if you can't manufacture all the, you know, the Columbia that you need for AUKUS, let's build it here. Has there been any consideration for, you know, working with our allies who do have that capability to sort of give us time to expand our capability and, you know, to build jointly?
Yeah, so there are no magic beans, as an old shipmate friend of mine, Tom Shugart, who has actually gone and published on the same, saying the same thing. There are no magic beans, and there are no cheap solutions, to include buying a ship, say, from Japan or South Korea, or even building a nuclear submarine in Australia that could be used in the U.S. Navy. A, it's going to take too long. Our sailors aren't trained on those platforms, even though there may be some components that are very familiar. The other is, we don't know how to sustain those ships. So if we were to get like a Japanese Mogami frigate, we know nothing about the supply chain. It's not something we can. So there is no easy solution. So ideas about buying a ship from an ally and just repurposing it as a U.S. Navy ship on its surface isn't going to work, not in the timelines we need. The other is, our allies also need us to grow our industrial maritime capacity. Because right now, as their biggest defense security assurance, we are extremely vulnerable because we have neglected our maritime industry. We rely on everyone else's, to include a lot of Chinese ships, to keep our economy going. That's huge leverage that an adversary has over, if you're a Japanese, you'd be very concerned, what will the Americans do when the Chinese start turning the screws on us? If we can't get the food, the petrol, the energy, we can't move things across the sea that we need to sustain our economy, how would we respond to a crisis in Asia? So there's a lot of interest by our most vulnerable allies in Asia to help us regain our maritime strength. And we have to do it together. Again, the capital that's required is in the tens of billions of dollars over 10 years. It's a decade endeavor to do this right. So we're going to have to do that with our friends and our allies if we're going to be successful.
And do you see, you know, you talked earlier about the capital required to come in. I mean, because these, for our listeners who may not be familiar, the capital investment in a new shipyard is just tremendous, and what you have to be able to do. Do you think that there's enough commercial investment, or is it going to take the U.S. federal government supporting it to make that happen?
It's going to take all of the above. So statements like President Trump's joint session before Congress earlier in the year, and then, of course, his executive orders to regain a maritime dominance, the actions the Federal Maritime Commission has taken, and USTR to complaint against Chinese bad business practices, at the same time that you've got the U.S. Congress supporting the Ships for America Act and putting a lot of money in like reconciliation and in the defense budgets, that's the positive signal that's attracting business to the United States and even within the United States. Hopefully it attracts those that are in, you know, adjacent industries to get into shipbuilding, because we need more players on the waterfront, so to speak. And we can do that without putting in jeopardy the bottom line of the existing big shipbuilders for the Navy today. But as far as what government's role is, it's providing a favorable environment, regulatory as well as taxing. It is also incumbent on the government to provide a clear indication, a demand signal for ships in the beginning. That's the priming of the pump. And then as American shipbuilding takes off, is competitive again, that need starts to wither, and hopefully it'll be able to be self-sustaining. And again, that's why the goal has to be a competitive global shipbuilding and shipping industry in the United States. But it doesn't mean that we dominate it, like we take away market share from everyone else. That's not necessary to get back to the healthy industrial base that we need.
Yeah, it's a significant question. Now, it's that time in the show where we have to take a quick break, so we will do that. And then when we get back, I want to ask you, what do you see as our strengths relative to the Chinese, and what do you see as their strengths relative to the United States? You're listening to NucleCast, and we'll be right back. And we're back, and we're talking to Brent Sadler about U.S. shipping and, you know, can we produce the Navy that we need to hopefully deter and, if not, defeat our biggest adversaries? And we know who we're talking about. So before the break, I mentioned our strengths and advantages versus those of the Chinese. So, you know, tell me about that. What are we good at? Where are we better? Where are they better?
Yeah. So it is a complex question to do it justice, but I'll try and boil it down to the wave top points on it.
Sure.
So for U.S. Navy, it has the experience of the Red Sea most recently, being shot at the same time having to dodge drones, both on the sea and in the air, in a coordinated joint combat arms kind of way. There's been an amazing amount of learning. That's not at the level of threat that the Chinese would represent. But we learned as a fleet a hell of a lot. The Chinese don't have that experience. They might be able to get the notes. They might be able to look at the homework that the Russians are learning in Ukraine and to be able to try to apply that to a Taiwan conflict. They are most undoubtedly, they are present in the Red Sea. They're watching and they're taking notes. But it's a whole nother thing when someone's shooting at you. How your sailors, how your ships, and how your systems respond. So that's an advantage, but it's a cautionary one. It's not good enough. The other advantage the United States has is we have a very robust network of allies with common interest. Just simply having a piece of paper that says that you're allies is not good enough. We have allies that share a lot of economic, cultural, and security interest. And that's really a hard thing for the Chinese to try to outdo, even if they may be one of these countries' number one trade partners. If you look at the top five trade partners, China may be number one, but if you look at the other four, they're all very much allies of the United States with common interest, And when you add them up, it's twice as big as the Chinese trade. So even countries that may think the economics will drive their future, the economics drive them right back to the U.S. and our network of allies. So that's a strength, and it transcends just the military. You were asking about the Chinese strengths. I view this as much a strength as it is a vulnerability. They have a command society and industry, and they're willing to take risk and throw money is not the issue for them. And it's a command communist society. And the advantage for that is if they decide something is necessary and it is makes sense, they can direct capital. They can direct the banks to put favorable loans. They can set the labor costs. They can set the material costs. They control all to get to this objective. The danger with that is if they've made a misjudgment or mistake, it's catastrophic. So single point failure, single point leadership, there's a good and a bad to that. And they've been able to do pretty well so far. But when the pace of things pick up in a conflict, that may become a liability for them. But right now it could be a strength, because the other side of this is it's given them an industrial advantage. I mean, they dwarf us. We are minuscule in naval shipbuilding compared to what the Chinese can do. So if we get into a long war with the Chinese, if we fight a very limited way, they're going to outbuild us. Even if we start trying to turn the screws on their supply chains, it's just not a very pretty picture. So they have those advantages. I wouldn't say they have advantage in military sensors and capabilities. Their ships are not better than ours necessarily. They certainly look good. They do look good. I'd have to say they've come a long way. And they have lethal weapons. And again, the picture is it good enough for the war they're planning? And I'd say, yeah.
Yeah, that's certainly a concerning assessment. But, the question I think back to the Soviets. When the Soviets would build, they would have many weapon systems on their ships. And oftentimes they knew that a good number of those weapon systems wouldn't work. And so they overbuilt for that failure. And I wonder if the Chinese have a similar issue, or are their, their systems and capabilities far more reliable than the Soviets were?
Yeah. So the issue with the Chinese and their confidence is that they haven't been tested. And they, in their own words, are concerned about their own material and even their training readiness in a fight with the United States. But they're also very aggressively training, exercising, live fire exercises, and very complex ones for the last several years. So this won't last long. Their confidence is actually on a very rapid upward trend. But again, it's a very hard to gauge how your military is going to perform until you're actually in a fight. And that's why I was mentioning earlier the lessons the U.S. Navy got in the Red Sea in combat, is something that is valuable in preparing and making sure that you are ready for what the fight might look like. And I think what we saw in the Red Sea is a little example of what we might see in a much more intense, much more lethal, certainly much more prolonged war in the Pacific.
Yeah, so it's a great question, because how you train is, you're going to fight like you train. And so I think back to the last deployment I was on, and we were doing undersea warfare exercises. Of course, U.S. subs are trying to pop up to get to the carrier, because that's what we were doing, was we were a destroyer squadron protecting a carrier. And I just wonder, do the Chinese have the technical capability to do those really well thought out, well planned, sort of realistic training exercises, like when they're operating with the Russians here lately? And we're watching that, and we're looking at what are they doing, and we're gauging and judging their competence and capability. And you look at it, are you saying, man, these guys are just about as good as us?
I guess the lens that I always look at them is, what's the mission? and how will they fight? Because there's always a danger to try to mirror. It's like, well, they're not fighting like the U.S. Navy, then they're not that good. Their fight is how to defeat our military in a conflict over Taiwan. And they have to be just good enough. And in that regard, they've built a military with long-range anti-ship ballistic missiles, a massive submarine force, largely diesel, conventional. So the range on those is not that great. Endurance is not that great. It doesn't have to be if you only have to go out maybe 100 miles away from your coast and just wait. They do also have nuclear submarines because they do want to get out and reach us at the same time. But their military is designed for a different type of fight. And one of the things they've done to mitigate their weaknesses is in numbers, in disaggregating their firepower across a larger fleet, and also on land with their rocket forces and with their air force, increasing numbers with long-range cruise missiles and even air-launched ballistic, hypersonic ballistic missiles. So they're working in a way to find where our weaknesses are in our way of fighting. And so targeting our logistics networks is something also worth talking about, perhaps.
Yeah, it's a challenging thing. And as I've, you know, I was in Hawaii maybe a month ago, and we played the Taiwan scenario in this war game we put on. And it was one of those interesting things where it's clearly going to be sea power. It's clearly going to be air power. And then the big challenge is, you know, and a lot of folks, a lot of, you know, CSIS and other think tanks and RAND have all played these war games. And a lot of times we lose, but there are times we also win. And I wonder, as you've participated and thought through these, what do you think is sort of that key to success for us? The thing that we need to be doing now before we find ourselves in any potential conflict. And maybe by getting to that point, we can deter the Chinese, because maybe they say the Americans are prepared.
Yes. The time for building more ships and more aircraft and even army type gear, like long range strike, we're past that point. Which means you have two things that you can do. You can change the way you operate, and that includes with your allies. And some of that's been happening in the last few years. And again, this reality is driving a sense of urgency, not just within like Indo-PACOM in Hawaii, but also with folks across the world, our allies in Tokyo, Seoul, and in Manila. So we have to operate our forces differently and more creatively together. And that needs to accelerate. That's one thing. The other is, since we don't have a whole lot of time, because the Chinese have made very clear, they've put resources and dedicated at the Secretary General. So Xi Jinping himself is committed to making sure his military is ready to fight and win against the United States by 2027. And they've been working at that very diligently as far back, starting back in 2014 and 15, when they started to reorganize their military for this purpose. So that leaves us in a place where, let's say, the Chinese now can decide when war occurs, because they're not deterred anymore after January 1st, 2027. The next best thing you can do with the time we have, really maybe a year and a half, 2 years of time, is start to grow the supply base. Because it takes about 2 years to get your suppliers up and running and producing at scale for the military and to sustain a wartime economy. Buying new shipyards and starting that's capital intensive. If you accelerate it in the best of times, that's a 5-year deal, but you still need more shipyards. So you're gonna have to look at the brownfield that already exists but are underutilized, making modernization and upkeeps, and then looking at where the greenfield, where you can start to break ground, so that if the Chinese decide in April of 2027, we're going to war against the Americans, and we have a shipyard that's only 10% begun and a brownfield that's like 60%, and we've modernized our 4 existing public shipyards, it's a lot better to be in that situation and to rapidly expand on a foundation than if we had done nothing from today till then.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Now, it's that time in the show where we have to bring out Bob the Genie. So as I rub my magic lamp, Bob, of course, grants all guests 3 wishes related to the topics we've been discussing. So with that in mind, Brent, what is your first wish?
A first wish is to get the leadership in place to execute this national rejuvenation. So get the maritime administrator in place and get the Navy shipbuilder. This is the Assistant Secretary for Research, Development, Acquisition, because these are the folks that will be the highly technical experts with political authority to execute the president's and Congress's direction to revitalize our commercial and our military shipbuilding and shipping sectors. That's number one.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, you get two more. That's only one. So what's number two?
And wishing for more wishes is ixnay.
Yeah, that's ixnay. So second wish.
Second wish is I would, if I could wish overnight, I would wish back a 5th and 6th public shipyard, because our aircraft, nuclear aircraft carriers and nuclear submarines, the reason that you've got them, like the Boise now almost 10 years, you know, just sitting on the pier waiting for dock time, and is we don't have the capacity to maintain our nuclear fleet today. And it's clear that's one of our advantages over the Chinese is our nuclear submarine force. So I would wish for a 5th and 6th public shipyard, one of them somewhere in the Pacific.
Yeah, that's a good one. How about wish number three? Last one.
Well, the last one is I would wish for a commercial merchant marine fleet that's able to sustain the military. So 90 tankers. I'd love to snap my fingers and say we have 90 U.S. flagged crewed tankers.
Yeah, that's a good one. You know, I haven't kept up with where the merchant marines are in terms of, you know, their capability and capacity, you know, to do unreps and that kind of stuff. So so I assume they're having the same struggles as the rest of the.
Yeah, it's not a good picture. That I would love to have said that as I dig around trying to find when you're trying to solve a problem that's pretty big and complex, you want to start to find out where's the foundation where there's some goodness that you can stand on to try to bring the rest of the organization or to start to accelerate the effort. I haven't found the bottom of the deep end of the pool yet on this. So on the commercial side, this is our merchant mariners. The Military Sealift Command had to shutter 19 ships last year because they weren't able to crew them with the merchant mariners, the American civil seafarers that would drive those ships. And so it's a bad place to be. On top of that, we don't have enough ships. So we can't even man an inadequate fleet of commercial and logistic ships. I mean, that's how you think you've got to the bottom. There's even further to go. And I don't want to end on a sour note, but that's where we are.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess it's sort of a call to action, right? I mean, that's really what it is
well
it's
said.
A call to action.
Well
so, you know, hopefully the listeners will, you know, have heard this episode and will say, geez, man, we had no idea. It sounds a lot like the problem with putting sentinels in holes that, you know, we have a serious problem there. Well, now we know we have a serious problem with building, you know, the combat fleet and even the support fleet and the, you know, the merchant marine fleet that we need. So thanks for coming on and giving us and our listeners sort of a heads up on what's going on with the U.S. Navy.
No, thanks for the time to share my thoughts and great conversation. Thanks.
And of course, thanks to you, the listeners, and we will see you next time on NucleCast.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Grunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.